This podcast brought to you by Hope 103.2.
Hello, welcome to the Hope Mornings weekly podcast. Today, sexologist Dr. Patricia Werrikoon gives us some tips for getting the spark back into your marriage. Kai Chow from the Australian Financial Review discusses the closure of Toyota and the death of the car industry in Australia. Bad news for single ladies, Australia is in the grip of a man drought, according to social researcher Mark McCrindle. And Anne Hollands gives us some tips for getting over unrequited love. Plus sport with Luke Doherty and parenting with Colette Smart. It's all coming up in the Hope Mornings weekly podcast. Well, there's no question that we live in a sex-saturated society, but that doesn't mean we're getting better at it. If anything, we're probably more anxious than ever about sex, romance, and relationships. Dr. Patricia Werrikoon is a sexologist, and she's also the author of The Best Sex for Life, and she joins me in the studio. Hi, Patricia.
Great to be here. Thank you for having me.
So, when you say you go to a party and you say you're a sexologist, what kind of reaction do you get to that, Patricia?
Oh, the immediate thing is that I say, what is an old subcontinental woman being a sexologist? And then the words are, what does a sexologist do anyway? Which is a fascinating opening, because then I get to say a sexologist is somebody who reads about sex, researches sex, talks about sex for 24/7. Oh, that's just keeping a little time to have sex.
Do you ever get sick of sex?
Never.
Okay, where do you think we're mainly going wrong in society today when it comes to our attitude to sex?
We're going wrong because we are accepting the world view that desire means if I want something, if I desire it, I must have it. Mm. And therefore, it doesn't matter what I want, it doesn't matter who I hurt, or even if I hurt myself, I just need to feed my desires. But the Bible tells us that the best sex for life is in a monogamous relationship of one man, one woman, where you can have the naked and no shame. What does it mean? Naked means you are totally vulnerable. Mm. And when you are in a no shame relationship, you have perfect trust. Now, that is what we are now seeing research supporting, that actually it works.
And what's the key attitude to have in how we approach sex? Because if the world's attitude is desire and sort of getting what I want, and what I want I must have, what's a more Christian attitude towards sex then?
It's really about the other person. You say if two people love each other and they look into each other's eyes and say, what can I do for you that will make you happy, that will give you the best sex, the best pleasure you can ever have? Look, if both people are thinking that, what better sex can you have?
Yeah. All right, so what's your advice for putting the zing back into a marriage after a long time? How can you get the spark back into the marriage?
What a great question to ask a woman who's 40 years married this month. How do you put the zing back? You remember that the more sex you have, the more you bond at a brain level. But that is what we call a passional bond, not a passionate bond. So if you want to bring passion back into that long-term commitment bond, what I tell couples is just think back to things that gave you that zing, that gave you that adrenaline rush. Look, if that was bungee jumping out to the bridge, well, maybe not after 40 years of marriage. But think about things that gave you that excitement. And just treat yourselves as a couple to doing something special for each other and for yourselves as a couple. And look, I promise you, the zing will come back. But you've got to work on it. The thing that we think is that everything has to be spontaneous. Now, as you get old, a lot of things aren't quite spontaneous as they were before. And we do need to take that time to romance and to bring back the excitement. Think back. What turned you on when you were young? Mm. Relive those moments of romance.
Thank you so much for coming in and having a chat about sex today.
You're most welcome.
Dr. Patricia Werrikoon, she's a sexologist and the author of The Best Sex for Life. Well, the big news of the day, of course, is the fact that Toyota is closing in Australia by 2017, which basically means the end of the car industry in Australia. Kai Chow from the Australian Financial Review is on the phone to help us dissect this. Hi, Kai.
Good morning, Katrina.
Now, there's been a few different sort of versions of how many jobs exactly will be lost. How are you seeing this?
Well, I suppose we're seeing all of those different estimates as well. So we know that there's the 2,000 jobs that Toyota has announced will directly be going. However, in terms, of course, of the flow-on effect, you have a components industry as well, and that has about 40,000 workers. And look, you know, when you've got three of the major manufacturers that you've been supplying to essentially disappearing within the next few years, some of the representatives there have already said that they may not exist at all anymore. And certainly we've seen estimates, so it depends on the economic assumptions you mean, but we've seen estimates ranging from 25,000 jobs, and that's from a former chairman of the Automotive Industry Authority, to really as many as like 65,000 or more going. So I see Bill Shorten's picked 50,000 jobs as the number which he thinks is going to go.
Okay.
So certainly in any case, it's a large number, Katrina, but it is important to remember that in a workforce of 13 million, the overall impact on the economy may not actually be that large. Of course, that's not much consolation to the people themselves who are losing their jobs, of course.
And what did the Toyota say were the main causes for them having to close?
Yeah, well, it's interesting, Katrina, that they have nominated quite factors beyond our control. Reasons such as an unfavourable Australian dollar. They're saying our dollar is too high. Mm-hmm. Our local costs here in Australia are too high. They've said that it's just too competitive here. There are actually over 60 car brands in Australia, which is great when you're a consumer to choose from, but it's very, very stiff competition. And so let me give you an example. Toyota had two of the top three selling cars in Australia, but those cars, the Hilux and the Corolla, were made in Thailand and Japan. So, you know, certainly that's what they're saying. Now, what behind closed doors is being said is that they've been telling the government that it's the workforce that is a big problem as well. It's a highly unionized workforce that they say, you know, for example, has a compulsory five-week shutdown over Christmas. Some have reported that there's a few rorts going on as well, and that they've been looking to put to the union some reforms to change some of that culture, and the union essentially stonewalled it. So now, of course, the union is saying that's not the case at all. The workers are saying, look, this probably would have happened anyway. We don't think our working conditions would have made a difference in the end.
Yeah, it's interesting, though, that this has just come so closely after the big debate with, was it the SPC factory, where they were talking about working conditions being too high. So it's become very politicised, hasn't it,
this issue of labour? It's yet another big political challenge for the Abbott government. We've seen these kind of huge job losses or impending job losses face prime ministers before. For example, when Telstra was semi-privatised, and, you know, so how you deal with that? Well, in the past, some prime ministers, of course, pumped a huge amount of money to kind of soften the blow, so to speak, or to ease people out of the industry. But it's very expensive. I mean, in an industry that's already been getting $120 million a year per company in government grants, you know, the kind of parachute, so to speak, is going to be quite expensive as well. And of course, the government is of course blaming the unions, and Bill Shorten and the unions are blaming the government for not talking to Toyota, and the government saying, well, they were going to do it anyway because you guys are making it too difficult for them.
Yeah, right. I guess you can just see this as the last in a long line of sort of gradual lowering of protection, not just for the car industry, but way before that for a lot of our industries, such as agriculture, and, you know, that it's kind of like the final step of the whole free trade movement, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely, Katrina, especially, and that's obviously going to be a hallmark of this particular government. They are a liberal government, even though the political parties these days aren't as different as, in some other countries. Mm. And you can see that in some of the comments being made about the car manufacturing industry today by both sides of politics.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you very much, Kai Chow, for filling us in. And I guess all of us are going to have to wait and see as to how this plays out on the economy down the track, aren't we?
Absolutely.
Yeah. That's Kai Chow from the Australian Financial Review talking about the closure of Toyota for 2017. Well, it's common for children to have anxieties that can seem a little silly to adults. They may be scared of lifts, escalators, thunderstorms, or the dark. But what's the difference between normal childhood worries and a more problematic kind of anxiety disorder? Psychologist Colette Smart from Family Smart is our special guest today. Hi, Colette.
Hi, good morning.
Now, we all have some sort of healthy levels of anxiety, don't we? But when does it become a problem?
Oh, healthy anxiety is something that we all have. It's an adaptive behavior or response. So it helps us prepare for real dangers like crossing the street alone or helping us actually perform at our best. Sometimes mm-hmm. it motivates us to study better and so on. But when it becomes a problem is when these kind of anxieties start to cause all sorts of distress and issues that actually interfere with everyday life and everyday situations.
So what are some of the most common signs of anxiety in small children, Colette?
Well, I think because kids and teenagers are anxious, and when they're anxious, a lot of them withdraw or become quite quiet and compliant when they're in anxiety-provoking situations. And so sometimes they can go unnoticed. Sometimes you will get other behaviors that you don't realize are part of the anxiety. So you could get children that become clingy or crying. An external behavior would be your child who has lots of tantrums, mm-hmm. excessive shyness, children who worry constantly about tiny things. These children will often try and avoid situations or places because of that fear. They might complain about stomach aches or headaches when you realize they actually aren't sick. And, you know, one of the most common things that we see is this avoidant behavior, and that can become quite habit-forming, and that is the most ineffective way of coping with anxiety in the long run. So it's dealing with that, really, that we've got to look at.
What's an example of an avoidant behavior?
So an avoidant behavior would be things like trying to avoid walking with mum up to the school gate because the child knows that they're going to go to school now.
Okay.
So you'll have your child sitting down on the side of the street.
The pavement, yeah. Okay. How do you know, sort of, say your child is doing an avoidant behaviour like that, how do you know when to sort of accommodate that or when to push through?
Look, I think it's important to reduce stress where possible for big events. Some things are just part of life and we've got to push our children to learn certain skills. So if there's a big event coming up at school and you know that they're afraid of the swimming or running carnival, just saying you don't have to swim every time is not helpful to them. So talk about the upcoming event. Go to a swimming coach. Learn the skills. Creating and sticking to routines are very important for anxious children, obviously within reason. And then being supportive, so don't just say, oh, don't be silly, but also try not give excessive reassurance. So say your kindy child is still struggling in the mornings with drop-off. If you keep going back for the third, fifth, sixth hug, they start to learn that as part of their adaptive behavior, and then they expect six hugs every morning.
Mm.
Also being realistic, so praise little steps, and just little steps are what you're really trying to
work towards. You can't expect to cure an anxiety instantly, can you? It's something that probably takes time and constant sort of working at. Like, for example, my two-year-old is quite scared of swimming in the sea, and so one of the things I've started to do is just walk out into the sea holding her without actually making her go in yet, but just getting her used to being around it. Is that the sort of thing that you can kind of do when you talk about baby steps?
Yeah, I mean, my daughter actually was exactly the same, and when she was little, we used to sit miles back from where the waves came in, and slowly we moved forward, and then we'd hold her, and then slowly put her feet in, and, you know, and one of my other children often gets anxious about any kind of new activity or sport, but once they're involved in the sport, they love it. So kind of expect a backlash for a little while, but don't let them continually avoid. Basically, avoid avoidance.
Okay, so avoidance is like the worst thing, is it, for anxieties?
Yeah, just avoiding it doesn't actually teach them anything. They just learn, if I avoid it, I don't have to face difficult situations. And so you don't really teach them life skills for as they grow, and that doesn't create resilience.
Yeah, okay, that sounds like the key sort of take-home message, avoidance,
yes.
As ironic as it sounds. Now, if people have got to the point where they really do need some help...
Look, there's actually some great courses around. There's one actually happening in the Epping area at the Resilience Centre. So there's some at Macquarie Uni. If your child really is at the point where you've tried everything, I think it's important to seek professional help.
Thank you, Colette. That's Colette Smart from Family Smart. You can find her online at familysmart.com.au. Does it ever seem as if there just aren't enough good men to go around? Well, there's a reason for that. Australia is in the grip of a man drought. There are almost 100,000 more women than men. That is the dire news from social researcher Mark McCrindle from McCrindle Research. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Katrina.
What are the main reasons behind the man drought?
Well, it shows the interstate flows that we have in our population, particularly around employment, and it highlights that men are prepared to travel more for those jobs than women. So yeah, that's one of the key factors. You get this flow of men because of the mining boom and resources boom to Western Australia, and because of the military bases up to the top end, and that means actually that there are fewer men than women in most of the southern and the eastern states.
Okay, so where are the areas of Australia where the man drought is most severe?
Victoria leads the charge. You've got just 98 men for every 100 women.
Oh,
and New South Wales, not too far behind the man drought stakes, but also Queensland, South Australia, Tasmania all have more women than men. And that's because, well, a number of factors. You don't have the industry bases that are going to pull men from the other states, fairly diversified fields, but also you've got older populations in most of those states, and women in Australia outlive men by about 4 years. So the older the average population, the more likely you'll have more women.
But aren't there actually more boy babies born in Australia than girl babies?
That's exactly right. So for every 100 baby girls born, there are about 104 baby boys born. And the males are actually more numerous in Australia than females until the mid-30s.
Oh.
And from the 30s right through to the 60s, that's where the man drought really hits. And again, partly because you've got a lot of men that are prepared to travel, particularly overseas. And so that's why we have a deficit of men in those age groups.
So not only do we have less men, but the really successful ones are going overseas.
or maybe those that are putting career above relationships.
Right. So you wouldn't want them anyway.
Exactly. And look, there are solutions within our own country. You know, women can head west or head north. Basically, anywhere with a mining facility or a military base will offer some solutions. You'll find more men than women.
Might be hard for a girl to get a job, though.
Well, these days, the mining sector, I mean, most sectors obviously are looking for women, but it does just show the strength of the mining sector. It is Australia's biggest employer in terms of total numbers, and the fact that it can even tip the balance and create a man supply in WA is an example. In fact, 5 years ago, there was, even WA was in man drought, but now more men than women.
It's a bit drastic, though, if you've got to move from Balmain to Cooper Pedy or, you know, somewhere to get a bloke.
Well, a more simple local solution is to move from Balmain to Pyrmont. You see, in Balmain, there are about 9% more women than men. There's a man drought in Balmain, but there's a man supply in Pyrmont just over the Anzac Bridge. It's quirky how these things work, but you've got side-by-side suburbs. Some will have more women than others. And that one, the Anzac Bridge, and why that separates the man drought from the oversupply of men in Pyrmont, is simply just, again, workforce reasons. Balmain has a lot more industries or businesses, small-based businesses in the PR and communication sector, and a lot of retirees as well, making it more female-focused. And Pyrmont is where a lot of men are based, and they head off into the... put the suits on and head off into the city, and the inner city areas of most of our capitals also have more men than women.
There you go. So what are your tips for getting around the man drought, Mark?
Well, one thing is keep in mind the age. It cuts in at the mid-30s. So prior to that, there's actually more men than women. And women in Australia are marrying about age 28, 29, and they marry 2 years older than their own age. But if they marry around the same age or even slightly younger, in fact, by the mid-20s, you've actually got 103 males for every 100 females. So there are some solutions in terms of, you know, age.
There you go. So, like, women in their early to mid-30s need to be open-minded about marrying men a little bit younger.
Yeah, well, not leave it too late. By the mid to late 30s, the man drought's on. And also, you know, look around, as we saw, you know, there are some towns. Singleton is living up to its name. 5% more men than women, and a lot of single fellows up there as well, mining influence. But yeah. You know, there are some geographical solutions as well.
Oh, that's funny. All right. Well, thank you, Mark. I think you could be making a lot of women feel better at the moment, you know, because they can say, well, look, it's not me. It's just the fact that there's a shortage of blokes.
There is. It's a demographic fact.
That's right. Thank you for filling us in today.
No worries. Thanks, Katrina.
Mark McCrindle from McCrindle Research. And yes, the country is in the grip of a man drought. We have heard some happy stories this week from couples who found true love, even love at first sight. But not everybody gets the happy ending. What about when love is one-sided, with one person putting all the effort into the relationship and the other person barely noticing or appreciating? I'm sure we've all heard the frustrated expression, he or she don't even know I exist. Well, the poet Sylvia Plath said, when you give someone your whole heart and he doesn't want it, you cannot take it back. It's gone forever. That's a bit of a depressing view of love. But how do you know when it's time to let go? Family and relationship psychologist Anne Hollins has a few words of wisdom for us. Hi, Anne.
Hi, Katrina.
Yeah, why do people go on hoping and loving someone when every logical part of them knows that the other person doesn't feel the same way? Is it just a state of denial?
Well, yes, I think it is. Isn't that a depressing quote from Sylvia Plath?
Yeah.
And don't agree, by the way.
Well, she didn't have a happy ending either, so, you know.
No, I don't agree with that at all. But we are a little prone to, a bit of self-delusion. Maybe it's not so much denial, but a bit of delusion. In that we kind of get ourselves sort of hooked on an idea, and then the hormones kick in. And we can get a little bit obsessed.
I wonder if there's a bit of escapism in this because, you know, if you're not actually a couple, the other person can stay idealised and perfect.
Yeah, absolutely. It's really the fantasy of a relationship rather than a real relationship, of course. And so, and the more elusive they are, the more you fantasise. And look, we really are kind of led by our sort of biology here. There's a lot of hormones that kick in, and that can kind of lead to us being obsessive beyond the point of where it's good for us, even when the signals that the other person's giving may be indicating that they're not that into you after all.
So what are some of the signs or signals that maybe he or she is just not that into you? Yeah.
Well, you know, it can be a bit tricky to decipher, but I reckon it's things like they don't call you when they say they would.
Okay.
That's a fairly good sign. You know, maybe once they forgot or got busy or something, but if it's a bit of a pattern. But also just generally being unreliable or unpredictable. You know, if they were as keen on you as you are on them, then they would be focused on this thing just like you are. Mm. So if they're not behaving in the way that you would expect them to, then probably there is some evidence there, and we should be paying attention to that. And not taking it too personally, because, you know, it could be for a whole lot of reasons going to do with that person and what's happening in their lives. But it may not be the right thing for you right now.
But women have a great capacity, especially to make excuses for men. You know, maybe he's been too busy to call me. He wants to ask me out, but he's a bit shy. I think he loves me. He just hasn't had the courage to tell me. He's been stressed lately. You know what I mean? All this stuff goes on in ladies' heads.
Well, that's the whole point. The whole thing is going on in your head. It's not in the real world at all. And at some point, we have to face up to that fact. And sadly, you know, a lot of us, you know, we can actually continue that fantasy relationship for a long time. So, look, I think it's a human thing. We've all done it at some stage. It's a very, very common thing. And I guess if we're a friend or a family member of someone who perhaps is just obsessing for a little too long, then maybe it's a time to have a sort of a gentle chat with them and in a kind, compassionate kind of way, help them see beyond that particular fantasy.
Yeah, well, I was wondering about that. If it is, you know, unhealthy to keep putting emotional energy into someone who doesn't feel the same way, how do you make the break? If someone's listening to this and they're going, yep, I know that's me, how can I make the change?
Well, you know, I think you've got to recognise that if you've obsessed for a long time, it's almost like you're splitting up from a relationship. Mm. It's not quite, but it's almost is. So you've got to do something quite drastic, I reckon. And that means, you know, go and get your hair cut, or, you know, get a new hairstyle, go on a holiday, do something, change your routines, take up a new hobby, do something that actually allows you to focus on something different in your life, start to make new friends potentially and look beyond that particular scenario. But I wouldn't suggest you sort of, you know, necessarily just, you know, pack up and move overseas. But, you know, don't make any sort of rash major decisions, but take a break. Take a break, pick up something new that's going to interest you, and then assess things after that.
Oh, that's a good idea, Anne. Thanks for your expert advice.
My pleasure.
I hope this is going to be a turning point for somebody who's listening right now. That's relationship psychologist Anne Holland. She's talking about unrequited love and a few telltale signs that it might be time to move on.
Hope 103.2 Mornings, talking sport with Luke Doherty.
Now, look, you know, it's Valentine's Day and Luke Doherty, Mitchell Johnson has been breaking hearts today.
You've just reminded me that it's Valentine's Day.
Yeah, what have you got planned for your beloved Luke? What amazing demonstration of your love and passion is going to be unveiled when you get home from work?
Look, we've been married for about 8 years now, which, you know, is no excuse to slacken off. So, you know, the life of a sports reporter is that you generally work weekends. And my wife has been, you know, we've discussed this in the past, and you'd know it being the wife of a sports reporter as well.
So I guess
a weekend widow.
Sports journalist widow, yep, that's right, weekend widow, yep.
Yeah, exactly right. So I got in early last night. I bought flowers. My wife went to help her friend clean a house that they've just finished building. And so she got home and there were flowers there. I thought, oh, I've got in early, I'm in the good books. And then she just looks at me and says, oh, you don't really buy me flowers that often, do you? So why should today be, you know, special at all? So I'm going, oh, that's good. So, no, I didn't get much credit for getting flowers early, which was a little bit interesting.
The thing I find with most men, Luke, is that they always say they don't believe in Valentine's Day, but somehow they did believe in it before you were married.
No, but you know what? Every woman says, oh, no, I don't want anything, don't get me anything. But if you don't, I tell you, there's a price to be paid if you show up with nothing. My wife did say, look, every day is Valentine's Day now. How funny. So that's you know, I'm on the right track.
Well, you're doing well. All right.
Well,
so
let's try.
Let's talk about the other heartbreaker, Mitchell Johnson.
What's been
happening?
Look, he did well. He did well in South Africa. We know that we've talked at length about how good Mitchell Johnson was during the Ashes series. And really, this has been one of the most remarkable career revivals from a bowler that many thought would never, ever get near an international test match ever again, just because he was so wayward. He mentally just wasn't in the game and wasn't up to dealing with the pressure that comes with being an international cricketer. Funnily enough, it's since he's settled down and had a baby that he's actually become this fierce, fast bowler again. And everything, once he's off the field, life was settled. And you find that in so many walks of life in sport. Once they get their off-field life settled, their on-field performance seems to excel tenfold. And Mitchell Johnson, this was the big test. They're playing South Africa, the number one ranked test team in the world. Australia's ranked third. So this is their big chance to go over to South Africa and show everyone what they're made of. And Mitchell Johnson came up with figures of 4 for 51 overnight. Absolutely terrorised South Africa. They said in the lead-up that, yeah, look, England, they just didn't play him that well, basically. We're used to playing fast bowlers, and he's not really going to scare us. He came out and gave them the fright of their life. So the South Africans are 6-140 heading into day 3 of play tonight. That is in reply to Australia's 397. So the Aussies well on top.
That's fantastic. I was also quite touched to hear that the Australian team wore black armbands in honour of Luke Batty, the 11-year-old from Taibb Cricket Club, who was tragically killed by his father at cricket practice. So that was very touching that they did that. Now, moving on, there will be a very unexpected meeting at the Auckland Nines this weekend when Brad Fittler comes up against his protege.
Yeah, look, you probably could have written your own ticket in the bookmaking sense on this one. If you had said about 12 months ago that there was going to be a pre-season NRL tournament that was 9 players aside, 9-minute halves, it was going to be staged in Auckland for massive prize money, that Brad Fittler, one of the all-time greats of rugby league, was actually going to be coming out of retirement at the age of 42 and playing in it, and that he was going to be coming up against a bloke that he discovered on a rugby league missionary type trip to Fiji. He was working as a porter at a Fijian hotel, and him and both Fittler and Andrew John saw this bloke bloke and thought, my goodness, you're going to be an absolute star at rugby league. So they went out into a little bit of a field in Fiji, kicked a few balls around, watched him catch them and run them back, and then told Penrith about him. And Penrith ended up recruiting him purely on the word of Brad Fittler and Andrew Johns. I guess there's probably no two better judges to recommend you a player. And he's ended up slotting into life at Penrith pretty well, and they've included him, the Panthers, in their squad for the Auckland Nines this weekend. And Fittler, who will be, for some reason, has come out of retirement to play for the Roosters just in this tournament, will actually be going up against Penrith and his protege, Edu Nabali, who he discovered, as I said, as a porter at the Fijian Hotel. It's a remarkable story.
It is. That's really cool. And look, finally, we're gunning for another medal at the Winter Olympics tomorrow.
Yeah, we are indeed. The early hours of tomorrow morning, fingers crossed, Lydia Lassler, four-time Olympian in the aerial skiing. She's defending her gold medal in this event from Vancouver 4 years ago. So we have fingers crossed for her. Of course, we're coming off that silver medal that Tora Bright won in the snowboard halfpipe. I think we're all trying to, every sports journalist in the country is trying to make their viewers believe that they know, you know, what a McTwist is and all these things that the commentators are coming up with that we wouldn't have the slightest clue what they were. But, yeah, it's fun to watch.
Okay. Well, thanks for that. Enjoy your sport and happy Valentine's Day, Luke.
Yeah, likewise. Happy Valentine's Day to you.
That's Luke Doherty from Sky News Sports.